Hello and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes we'll be featuring articles from the New York Times, from The Guardian, from Religion News Service, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and unless otherwise noted, all articles are read as printed. Don't forget that podcast editions of this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article published on March 29th in the New York Times. And this article is entitled, Hillsong, Once a Leader of Christian Cool, Loses Footing in America. The subheadline, amid a series of crises, including the resignation of its leader, the evangelical powerhouse has shed more than half its American churches in just a few weeks. This article is by Ruth Graham of the New York Times. Terry Crist, a fifth-generation pastor in Phoenix, joined the global megachurch Hillsong in part because of what he describes as its distinctly joyful approach to church life. Hillsong was an institution where leaders seemed light and free, offering a church experience that attracted tens of thousands of people around the world. Starting in Phoenix, Mr. Crist eventually brought six churches in two states into the Hillsong fold. Last week, he took them out. "We cannot continue in our global family, as much as we love it," Mr. Crist told his congregation in an emotional sermon on Sunday, citing, among other reasons, the recent resignation of Hillsong's global leader under a haze of scandal. "I am heartbroken." In the last 2 weeks, Hillsong has lost 9 of its 16 American church campuses, a swift and stunning decline for one of the world's largest and most influential evangelical churches. Just a few years ago, Hillsong was the leading edge of cool Christianity, a quickly expanding network that appealed to young people and city dwellers with energetic, stylish preachers and an upbeat atmosphere. Hillsong translated the charismatic church experience, which emphasizes miracles and personal encounters with the Holy Spirit, for a hip, upscale audience. Justin Bieber and the NBA star Kevin Durant attended services. One of the church's worship bands won a Grammy Award, and the church produced soaring anthems that became staples in smaller churches that imitated its sounds, style, and Instagram-friendly aesthetic. Now Hillsong's U.S. presence is in collapse. Its remaining U.S. locations are in the Northeast and California, meaning Hillsong no longer has a major presence between the coasts. The departures are partly the fallout from a series of crises, most recently the sudden resignation of its charismatic founder, that have left the church with a tarnished reputation and instability that pastors say they found increasingly difficult to endure. "I can't think of a church in the English-speaking Western world with as broad a global reach as Hillsong," said Ed Stetzer, the executive director of the Wheaton College Billy Graham Center in Illinois. "The current upheaval at the church is a very big deal and will have ramifications not just for Hillsong, but for contemporary evangelicalism around the world," he said. The church was already grappling with in-house tensions and a damaged brand when its Australian founder and global leader, Brian Houston, resigned on March 23rd after an internal investigation found that he behaved inappropriately toward two women. Mr. Houston had stepped away from all ministry duties in January, explaining that he needed to concentrate on fighting a criminal charge of concealing child sexual abuse committed by his late father, who was also a pastor. The church's investigation found that Mr. Houston sent inappropriate text messages to one staff member, and that several years later he spent time alone in a hotel room with a woman who attended the church's annual conference in Sydney. In a statement to the New York Times, the press office for the church said there have been no other complaints about Mr. Houston's behavior. The church has blamed medication and alcohol for Mr. Houston's actions. Mr. Houston has not publicly commented on his resignation. He could not be immediately reached for comment. Phil Dooley, the church's interim global leader, responded to some questions in an email through the church press office. In the email, Mr. Dooley said Mr. Houston's resignation came as a tremendous surprise to many members of our community. The church press office did not respond to questions about whether Mr. Houston would receive a severance package or any future financial compensation from the church. The press office also declined to say whether Mr. Houston's wife, Bobby, whose title was also global senior pastor, remained employed by the church. On Thursday, a day after Mr. Houston's resignation, the streaming service Discovery Plus released a three-part documentary, Hillsong, a Megachurch Exposed. The documentary depicts the megachurch as a toxic institution obsessed with image, control, and growth at all costs. It features interviews with critics, former employees, and members, and a woman who has said she had a month-long affair with Carl Lentz, at the time the celebrity lead pastor of Hillsong's East Coast branches. The press office for the church said in an emailed statement that the documentary's portrait of Hillsong is almost unrecognizable to the church community. Mr. Dooley, the interim leader, said in an email to the Times through the church press office that he has been talking with members of our team around the world in what seems like a nonstop conversation since the revelations of Mr. Houston's behavior. He described the crisis as a challenging and emotional time for both members and leaders. This difficult season has sparked conversations that we should have been having as a church for a very long time, he said. He said the church is reviewing its policies and procedures to provide both health and accountability for leaders. Hillsong exercises some control over the financial operations of each member church, though congregations set their own budgets. Churches also pass on 5% of the contributions they receive to the global church. In return, they receive organizational and teaching resources, and what was at one time a straightforwardly valuable association with one of the most recognizable evangelical churches in the world. For some leaders of local Hillsong branches, the baggage has become too burdensome to be worth the benefits of affiliation. Last week, the lead pastor of Hillsong Atlanta, Sam Collier, emailed his church to inform them that he was withdrawing his church from Hillsong in the wake of consistent media attacks, slander, and accusations against Hillsong, some of which he acknowledged were true. All the challenges and the speculation and the scandal and the articles and all of the above, it got to a point where the people in our church just did not want to deal with it anymore, Mr. Collier said in an interview. His hiring as Hillsong's first black lead pastor was announced about a week before the news of Mr. Lentz's misconduct became public in 2020, meaning his entire tenure at the church has been clouded by scandal emanating from Hillsong entities far from Atlanta. Sunday service was the last for Hillsong Atlanta. We believe the Lord is calling us to move into the next season, Mr. Collier told his congregation. Mr. Collier is launching a new church on Easter Sunday and expects much of his Hillsong congregation to migrate there. The press office for Hillsong said there were no plans to reestablish Hillsong Atlanta. Another branch, Hillsong Kansas City, which launched in 2019, quietly separated from Hillsong about 2 weeks ago and relaunched as Kingdom City Church. The press office for the global church said the two parties made a mutual decision to separate before Mr. Houston's departure. A person who answered the phone at Kingdom City last week said the church had no comment. Hillsong's website says 150,000 people attend services weekly in 30 countries, but that estimate was taken before the pandemic. The press office said an accurate attendance count is not possible because of pandemic restrictions in some countries, and emphasized the church's longtime focus, heightened during the pandemic, on online participation. Mr. Houston and his wife Bobby are towering figures in Australia. The church grew for decades as part of the Australian branch of the Assemblies of God, a Pentecostal denomination. The church offered original music with high production values, sometimes performed in actual concert venues. Mr. Houston once instructed pastors in Australia that a Hillsong sermon leaves people feeling better about themselves than when they came in. Pentecostalism, a charismatic movement, often features practices like speaking in tongues and faith healing. Hillsong took a more accessible approach. Always attuned to mass appeal, the church accentuated personal encounters with God, often through music. Hillsong became its own denomination in 2018. In 2020, the church's relationship with money, sex, and celebrity came under renewed scrutiny when Mr. Houston fired Mr. Lentz for leadership issues and breaches of trust, plus a recent revelation of moral failures. Mr. Lentz, a one-time mentor of Mr. Bieber and a celebrity in his own right, confessed that he had been unfaithful to his wife and withdrew from public life. For Mr. Christ, leaving Hillsong was the culmination of several years of doubts about the institution. He objected a few years ago, he said, when a global church restructuring disbanded his board of local leaders and put him directly under the authority of the Australia-based Global Board. And he bristled when he and other lead pastors were asked to sign non-compete and non-disparagement agreements in the wake of the scandal in the East Coast branches. He never signed. The church press office described the agreements as standard elements of their general contracts with church leaders. This decision wasn't arrived at lightly, and it was made calculating the significant cost, Mr. Christ said in an interview, mentioning the possibility for disillusionment and pain. but anyone who has been victimized in our church needs to be seen and heard. Mr. Christ expects to begin holding services June 1st under a new name to be determined. In a sermon on Sunday, Mr. Christ called for an internal investigation into Hillsong's global board, to make the findings of that investigation public, and to purge any board members who have protected the institution and not the people. We'll turn next to an article published on March 24th in Religion News Service, and this article is entitled, Jews Say Making Daylight Saving Time Permanent Threatens Morning Prayer. The subheadline, American Jewish Groups Say They Were Blindsided by the Lightning-Fast Passage of a Senate Bill. This article is by Michelle Chabin of Religion News Service. American Jews say they were blindsided by the U.S. Senate's lightning-fast passage of a bill to make daylight saving time year-round and intend to fight it. The Sunshine Protection Act, which passed the Senate on March 15th, will make it nearly impossible for Jews to pray communally in the morning, Jewish advocates say, and still get to work or school on time during the winter months. According to Jewish law, morning prayers must take place after the sun rises. Daylight saving time, which currently begins on the second Sunday in March and ends on the first Sunday in November, extends darkness on late winter mornings. It will affect our religious life, our professional life, and our family life, said Rabbi Abba Cohen, Vice President for Government Affairs for Agudath Israel of America. If congregational and personal prayers begin after 8 in the morning, how will people get to work at 9 a.m. or earlier? Cohen said Agudath Israel has issued a statement and sent a detailed explanation of these difficulties to lawmakers in the House of Representatives, whose leaders have not said whether they will bring up the bill for a vote. In Judaism, the morning prayer service, called Shacharit because it starts after dawn, or Shachar in Hebrew, typically lasts 30 or 40 minutes when recited communally. Reading from the Torah and saying certain prayers, including the Kaddish or mourner's prayer, must take place in a group with a quorum of 10, known as a minyan. Unlike previous legislation on seasonal time changes, leaders of the Jewish community say lawmakers didn't inform them that the issue was on the Senate's agenda, or that it would be fast-tracked through a procedure called unanimous consent. Other stakeholders, from farmers to school teachers, also expressed surprise at the bill's quick passage. In a statement about the bill, Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, the measure's lead sponsor, said permanent daylight saving time would reduce car accidents, robberies, and seasonal depression, and promote physical fitness. Switching in and out of daylight saving time is outdated, and it's only a source of annoyance and confusion, Rubio said. Frankly, it's just dumb, and there's no other way to say it. Since the bill's passage, synagogues have begun circulating petitions, and some Jewish organizations have begun lobbying lawmakers against its implementation. In a document sent Monday, March 21st, Agudath Israel noted that under DST, sunrise in Detroit would occur after 8 a.m. for 131 days of the year, and after 9 a.m. on 23 days. In Cincinnati, sunrise would begin after 8 a.m. 135 days of the year. Such a late start would make it extremely difficult for religiously observant Jews who work outside their homes to pray in the morning, Cohen said. Morning prayers happen every morning, and it's not something employers are familiar with. Coming to work late every morning is a much bigger ask in American workplaces, Cohen said. As it is, many employers allow observant Jews to leave early for Shabbat, which can begin as early as 4 p.m. in some states. Needing to leave early on Fridays is an issue that Jews raise before they are employed. It's something that employers are familiar with. The same hasn't been true for morning services, Cohen noted. Nathan Diament, executive director for advocacy at the Orthodox Union, said the time shift is not only a Jewish issue. OU, Agudath Israel, and other Jewish organizations are also expressing concern about how the bill will impact school children, who will be traveling in the morning in the pitch black, and on health impacts for society as a whole. We'll be engaging with members of Congress, and just as we do on all kinds of issues, we'll work in coalition with other groups aligned on the same perspective on this issue, Diament said. While admitting that thwarting the bill's passage will be an uphill battle, I think it's possible the House won't pass it, Cohen said. Congress isn't passing it today, which gives us a chance to find our allies and for us to put our concerns forward. The next article is an essay that was published in the English newspaper The Guardian on March 28th, and this is entitled, The Big Idea, Do We Still Need Religion? The subheadline, In a World of Scientific Miracles, What Does Faith Have to Offer Us? And this article is by Robin Dunbar of The Guardian. In 2018, archaeologists moving bodies for reburial from a 19th century cemetery in Birmingham to make way for the new HS2 station were puzzled to find that several had plates on their laps. Then someone remembered a curious custom from the nearby Welsh marches, that of the village sin eater. A plate of bread and salt would be placed on the deceased's lap while they were lying in repose. Just before the coffin was closed and the funeral cortege set off for the church, the village sin-eater arrived, ate the bread, and was given some coins and a glass of ale for their trouble. The belief was that the deceased's sins were absorbed by the salt and transferred into the bread and then into the sin-eater. Sin-eaters were usually elderly and destitute and glad to have the money, not to mention the free food and drink. The price they paid was to be shunned by their community because of their macabre associations. The last known sin-eater was Richard Munslow, who died age 73 in 1906. Sin-eating reminds us that more than anything else, even the most staid of religions, in this case Anglicanism, can be associated with surprisingly curious beliefs and rituals. Perhaps because of this, it has often been claimed that religious belief arises from ignorance and superstition. If that were the case, you might expect religion to gradually fade away as societies became better educated and more scientifically oriented. There are at least two reasons, however, why religions persist. One is the fact that on average, religious people are generally happier, healthier, and live longer. For better or for worse, they also have easier deaths when the time comes. The other is that religious people are more likely to feel that they belong to a community. In a survey I ran, those who reported attending religious services were depressed less frequently, felt their lives were more worthwhile, were more engaged with their local community, and felt greater trust toward others. These enormous benefits mean not only that religion has enduring appeal, but that religious practices make you fit in the evolutionary sense, and thus they tend to stick around. Part of the reason people are attracted to religion is that its rituals, the standing, sitting, and kneeling in unison, the singing, the listening to emotionally rousing sermons, trigger the brain's endorphin system. This is the mechanism that underpins social bonding in all primates, including humans. Like opiates, endorphins produce a sense of bliss bordering on ecstasy, calmness and warmth, relaxation and trust, while elevating pain thresholds. In addition to these hedonic benefits, endorphins trigger the release of natural killer cells, part of the body's immune system. Endorphins also underpin the bonding of friendships, and through that allow us to create supportive groups of like-minded individuals. This effect seems to be especially strong in the context of rituals, as has been shown experimentally in religious services in the UK and Brazil. It seems, therefore, that religions evolve to reinforce a sense of community cohesion, something that's extremely important to our well-being and survival. Our natural community size, the size of our personal social network, the number of friends we have on Facebook, is part of a relationship between group size and brain size in primates. Each species has a characteristic group size determined by the size of its brain. Ours is about 150. Not only is this the average size of personal social networks, the number of extended family and friends with whom you have meaningful relationships, but it also turns out to be the optimal size for religious congregations. If a congregation is smaller than about 100, it puts a heavy burden on the membership. If it is above about 200, it becomes increasingly prone to divisiveness. This seems to explain why big religions are so susceptible to fragmentation, constantly throwing up small sects, typically of a few hundred people at most, built around a charismatic leader whose wayward beliefs the hierarchy desperately tries to contain. Social bonding is important, of course, to many species, but there's an aspect of religion that seems to be peculiarly human. Being able to engage in religious discussion, and hence explain the significance of the rituals and why you should take part, depends on the kinds of mind-reading or mentalizing skills that play a crucial role in managing our everyday relationships. These are the skills that allow us to understand what someone else is thinking to grasp their intentions. They allow us to utter sentences such as, "I know that you realize that Freddie believes that." To be able to do this, I have to be able to step back from the immediacy of the physical world so as to imagine the possibility that you might or might not think this, that Freddie might or might not intend whatever you thought he did, and even whether the person Freddie had in mind did or did not think what Freddie thought they did. Apes can do the first two steps in this chain, but that's the limit. For humans, it comes easily, bringing with it an ability to imagine parallel worlds inhabited by invisible beings. It's a short step from there to religious ideas, which in turn lead to better bonding, which makes you more likely to survive. Survival means your superior mentalizing skills will be passed on to a new generation, equally adept at religious thinking. A penchant for religion is therefore part of our genetic inheritance. But that's not all. The same cognitive abilities that give us religion also allow us to ask why the world has to be the way it is, giving us science, or to imagine entirely fictional worlds, giving us literature. Thus, you could no more have a world where religion was cast aside as superstition than you could have one without science or stories. And that would be a very different world indeed. Our final article this week on religion in the news comes from the online journal The Conversation. And this article is entitled, Two Orthodox Christian Countries at War. Here's an explanation of the faith tradition shared by Russia and Ukraine. This was published on March 28th, and the author is J. Eugene Clay, who is an associate professor of religious studies in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. President Vladimir Putin's decision to attack Ukraine has split the Orthodox Church. Patriarch Bartholomew of Constantinople, a leading authority of the Eastern Orthodox Church, quickly condemned the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. By contrast, Patriarch Kirill of Moscow, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church, has supported the war, which he claimed in a sermon was a struggle to defend human civilization against the sin of gay pride parades. As a scholar who has spent several decades studying religion in Russia, I'm following the debates within the Orthodox Church very closely. To better understand the current conflict, it is helpful to know more about the structure and history of Orthodox Christianity. Orthodoxy is the smallest of the three major branches of Christianity, which also includes Catholicism and Protestantism. There are about 1.34 billion Catholics, about 600 million Protestants, and about 300 million Orthodox Christians globally. Most Orthodox Christians live in Russia, Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and the Middle East. The word Orthodox means both right belief and right worship, and Orthodox Christians insist on the universal truth of their doctrine and practice. Like the Roman Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church claims to be the one true church established by Christ and his apostles. Unlike the Roman Catholic Church, which is led by the Pope, the worldwide Orthodox Church has no single spiritual head. Instead, the global Orthodox Communion is divided into autocephalous churches. Formed from two Greek words, the word autocephalous means self-headed. Autocephalous churches are completely independent and self-governing. Each autocephalous Orthodox church has its own head, a bishop who presides over the territory of his church. Some, but not all, of these presiding bishops bear the title Patriarch. The number of autocephalous churches has varied over time. The four oldest patriarchates, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem, were important religious and political centers in the Byzantine Empire. When Orthodox missionaries brought their faith to other countries, patriarchates were established in Bulgaria in the year 927, in Serbia in 1346, and in Moscow in 1589. In the 19th and 20th centuries, as the Ottoman and Russian empires fell apart, new autocephalous churches were formed in the new nations of Greece, Romania, Poland, and Albania between 1850 and 1937. Currently, there are 14 autocephalous Orthodox churches that are universally recognized in the global Orthodox community. All these autocephalous churches share the same faith and sacraments. Among the 14 churches, the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople is regarded as the first among equals. While the Patriarch of Constantinople enjoys a primacy of honor, he has no direct authority over the other churches. The Russian Orthodox Church, with over 90 million members, is by far the largest. The Romanian Orthodox Church boasts the second largest number of believers, with about 16 million. In Ukraine, Orthodox believers are divided between two competing church structures. The Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which was created only in 2018, is autocephalous. The Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate is under the spiritual authority of Patriarch Kirill of Moscow. Both Ukrainian churches have sharply condemned Russia's unprovoked war against Ukraine. Up until the 11th century, the Orthodox churches recognized the Roman Catholic Church as one of the autocephalous Orthodox churches. By 1054, however, differences in theology, practice, and church government led the Pope and the Patriarch of Constantinople to excommunicate each other. In particular, the Pope claimed to have authority over all Christians, not just the Christians within his autocephalous church. The Orthodox Church rejected this claim. These mutual excommunications were lifted only in 1965. In 1980, the 14 autocephalous Orthodox churches and the Roman Catholic Church created the Joint International Commission for Theological Dialogue to discuss the difficult issues that continue to divide them. These talks suffered a major blow in 2018 when the Russian Orthodox Church suspended its participation to protest the creation of a new autocephalous church in Ukraine. The Orthodox Church is hierarchical. Spiritual authority is invested in an ordained clergy consisting of bishops, priests, and deacons. Like the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church holds to the doctrine of apostolic succession. According to this doctrine, Orthodox bishops, who rule over the territory of a diocese, are the direct historical successors of the apostles. Bishops are exclusively male. They must also be monks and must observe a vow of celibacy. Priests and deacons, who are ordained by the bishops, lead the spiritual and ritual life of Orthodox Christians in the parishes. Unlike the bishops, parish priests are usually married. While priests must be male and most deacons are male, some women have been ordained as deaconesses since the early Christian period. Orthodox spiritual life is centered on the sacraments, or mysteries, usually celebrated by the parish priests. The first sacrament, baptism, is a rite of initiation into Christian life. Most Orthodox Christians are baptized as infants by triple immersion in holy water. Immediately, a baptized infant also receives two other sacraments. The priest anoints the child with chrism, a special oil prepared by bishops during Holy Week. The priest also gives the baby communion, the consecrated bread and wine that have mystically become the body and blood of Christ. Like Catholics and most Protestants, Orthodox Christians regularly celebrate the Eucharist. The central sacrament of the Orthodox Church is known as the Divine Liturgy. Celebrated every Sunday, the Divine Liturgy has three parts: the offering, in which the priest and deacon prepare bread and wine, the gathering, which includes the reading of Scripture, and the thanksgiving, in which the bread and wine are consecrated and given to the faithful. Much of the liturgy is sung or chanted. Unlike the Catholic Mass, the Divine Liturgy can never be celebrated by a single priest alone. The liturgy must always be celebrated by a community of Christians. While a Catholic church may have multiple masses on Sunday, the Orthodox Divine Liturgy can be celebrated only once per day on a given altar. Like Catholics, Orthodox Christians regularly confess their sins to their priest in the Sacrament of Penance. Marriage, ordination, and the anointing of the sick with holy oil are also recognized as sacraments. Icons, consecrated images of holy persons or events, play an important role in Orthodox church life. Orthodox churches are filled with these images, which believers honor with kisses and bows. In Orthodox theology, icons are a testimony to the doctrine that God became human in Christ. Because he was a human, he could be represented artistically. Likewise, the saints, who are believed to be filled with the Spirit of Christ, can be portrayed and venerated in icons. Orthodox theologians carefully distinguish between worship, which is offered to God alone, and veneration, which is appropriate for icons. Orthodox Christians form a worldwide community of increasing importance. After the fall of communism in Russia and Eastern Europe, the Orthodox churches of these countries have grown in numbers and in political influence. Well, that's it for our time this week. We thank you for tuning in and hope you enjoyed the program. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired, and we hope to talk to you next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.